Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
So hello and welcome to this episode of Turn the Page podcast, Syosset Public Library's podcast. I'm Stacey Muncher, a reader services librarian, and I'm here to interview a man with many hats. He's a writer, a bookseller, a director of a literary festival, and a lawyer. So please introduce yourself, Alex George.
Hi, Stacey. It's lovely to be here. It's looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So we got to know about you through your agent, because the paperback version of your latest book is coming out. It's already out because it came out May 4th. And that is the Paris Hours.
Right.
So that's exciting. Do you have a preference of hardcover or paperback of books you read?
For books I read, I own a bookshop in Columbia, Missouri, and so most of the books that I read now are galleys. Mainly, by virtue of that, they're mainly paperback. And these people who don't know, they're the sort of pre-publication copies that are sent out to librarians and booksellers and journalists and all those sorts of people to create buzz ahead of time. And I spend most of my time now reading those kinds of things, which is wonderful. It annoys everybody on social media because I post about these books and then I say, oh, by the way, it's not available until September. People get very cross. There's nothing quite like a good hardcover, I think. And so there's something special about, as an author, holding that hardcover in your hand and knowing that that's going to be, when it goes out into the world, that's the first time that people are going to sort of meet it, and that's great. Now, with the paperback, you know, it's different. I mean, there's usually a different cover. There is in this instance, the idea being that they're trying to reach maybe a different audience, or people who missed it last time around. So it's different. I mean, because it's still the same book. It's not quite as exciting, I think, when it comes out in paperback, but it's still fun. And, you know, the opportunity to, meet new people and get to a new audience is always good. So it's different for sure.
So you said how like the cover is different. Did you have input on both covers or was it a surprise?
It was a surprise. Macmillan are wonderful. They treat their authors just beautifully. And there was lots of conversations that went on about the cover. And they sort of asked me, they went through my previous covers of my previous novels and said, which ones did you like, and why didn't you like them, and all that good stuff. And then they said, do you have any thoughts? And I wrote back and I said, really just one, which is, please don't put the Eiffel Tower on the cover of this book. And, you know, bless them, they didn't. So that was nice. You know, I said, look, the word Paris is in the title. You're sort of, it's doing all the work for you. So, the cover of the hardcover in particular is, I just think, just gorgeous.
It is. I like the stairs. It's very, like, eye-catching. I was about to say provocative, but it's very eye-catching, and I like the color choice that they did. I wish I had a copy to be like, here, although it's a podcast, so people are going to be listening to us. So listeners, feel free to go to your local bookstore or the library's website to see the cover. We've got cover images.
Yeah, it's very nice. And it's actually, the photograph is of a very famous staircase in Paris. In a restaurant called Maxime, which is one of the most famous restaurants in Paris, and I don't know who that person is walking down the stairs, but it's beautiful. And you know, there have been occasions in the past in earlier books when we've looked at the cover, and you know, you have to go back to the publisher and say, we don't love it. But this one, right away, I fell in love, and we didn't change a single thing about it. It's just wonderful.
And the
paperback is different. You know, it's these people sitting at a cafe, very sort of French looking. So it's also evocative, but just in a different way. And, you know, I think that, you know, it speaks more to, you know, a lot of the action of the book happens outside. There are various people sitting in cafes. And so I think that was, they were just trying to capture a different sort of feel for it.
What inspired you to write this book?
So, you know, it's always interesting to sort of go back and look at that. And very often with my books, I'm not able to pinpoint the precise time when the idea crept into my head. But on this particular occasion, I can with a fair degree of specificity. And I know, for example, that it was on a Wednesday night. And I know it was a Wednesday night because I had just finished humiliating myself in my ritual game of indoor soccer. Which I play no longer, but I used to play. And I remember getting back into my car, sort of hobbling and groaning, and turning on the radio to drive home. And the radio was tuned to the local NPR station, and they played classical music. And there was this wonderful music playing. And at the end, the NPR announcer, sort of in those dulcet tones of NPR announcers everywhere, talked about the piece, and it was a piece by Maurice Ravel. And the announcer talked about the genesis of the piece, and it was actually commissioned by a Russian impresario called Serge Diaghilev, who began an innovative dance company in Paris called Les Ballets Russes. And he went on to talk about the extraordinary collaborations that Serge Diaghilev made to put these productions on. So Marc Chagall, for example, would paint the backdrop, and Coco Chanel would design the costume. I mean, it was, and then these extraordinary musicians would write music for it. It was absolutely bonkers. And I just sat there in the car just going, oh, well, that's my next book. I'm gonna write about Serge Diaghilev in Paris in the 1920s and this incredible coterie of geniuses that he sort of got to put on his productions. And so that was great. So I started researching Paris in the 1920s, and I lived in Paris. I went to school there, and I also worked there as a lawyer for a year, so I know it quite well. So I had a lovely time just sort of reading biographies and cultural histories and all these sorts of things. And then I sat down and wrote a totally different book. because I realized as I was going through and reading all of this stuff that, well, two things. First of all, that I worried that I wouldn't be able to do justice to these extraordinary people and their lives. And secondly, I began to question whether the whole endeavor was really necessary, because if you look at a Marc Chagall painting, or if you listen to a Ravel melody, I mean, the art speaks for itself. You really don't need someone like me to come along 100 years later and to try and tell you the story. So, but I was completely invested in Paris and in my research, and I really wanted to tell a story there. So I decided to redraw the focus away from all of that celebrity and instead to tell these different stories that are in the book. And so these four, for want of a better word, quieter stories of of ordinary people. And so that's kind of what I did. And so there are these four stories, and the book is really four independent stories which are linked. They sort of cross-pollinate each other at various points, and they all come together at the end. And it's told over the course of one day in Paris in 1927. And yeah, we go through the day with these four people. And there are still some famous people who make appearances, people like Ernest Hemingway and Gertrude Stein and Josephine Baker. But rather than, you know, originally my idea was that they would be at the heart of the novel, these famous people, but now they're very much on the periphery instead. So it's been a long, complex journey to get to this point, but that was how it began.
That's really cool, though. Like, when reading the summary and looking over the books, like, all I just kept thinking about, I was like, this makes me think of the Woody Allen movie, Midnight in Paris, of just, like, you have the group and he goes and visits them. But I'm just like, oh, these characters could be like, you know, the people like that he doesn't interact with, but like, you know, he sees when he's walking down the street. I have never been to Paris, so I always like reading about it. It sounds lovely. And I'm a big fan of historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I like finding stuff that, you know, is new, incorporates things I like, which would be Paris and historical, both, you win with this. But it's just always fun to find something, because usually, and as much as I love historical fiction, a lot of what comes out tends to be, it's like, okay, it's World War II, Holocaust fiction, and it's a great and interesting topic. You could do so much with it, but I like finding stuff that's a little kind of off the beaten path of like this.
Right.
And the 20s are such an interesting age, because you have, you know, the Roaring 20s happening in the US, abroad. So it's interesting to see that, because I don't typically find a lot, and I'm a librarian, I see a ton of books.
Right.
I'm like, oh, cool, Paris, 1920s, like the late 1920s, this is cool. So when you did your research, are any of the characters based off real people that you ended up reading about, or just completely your own?
So yes, one of the four characters is based on a real person. And that is Camille, who was based on, so Camille in the book is the maid of Marcel Proust, the great French novelist. And a lot of the stuff in there, a lot of the biographical detail that sort of fills the book and her backstory is based on the real life of Céleste Albaret, who was Proust's actual maid.
Oh.
And when I was doing the research for that original idea of the book, and I was reading about Proust, and Céleste Albaret at the end of her life wrote a memoir about her life with Proust, and a lot of the details in the book about, you know, he was a very kind man, but very, very weird and incredibly picky. And so he insisted, for example, that his coffee had to come from a particular shop on a particular street, and very, I mean, it would have been.
Oh.
Anyway, but all of that information that's in the book was from this memoir that Celeste wrote. And one of the things that she talked about was one day she was summoned to his studio, or his bedroom, which was famously cork lined, so there was no noise. And he asked her to burn 32 notebooks that he had stacked up on his dresser for the last, I don't know how many years, that contained the skeleton, if you like, of In Search of Lost Time, you know, his enormous 7-volume work of art. And, you know, immediately, so I'm the sort of person who, you know, if I've written half a sentence, I hit control save, because I'm just terrified of losing anything if the power goes out. And so the idea that these 32 notebooks would just be burnt and forever rendered into a pile of ashes, never to be read again, just sent me into severe conniptions. And I sort of began to have anxiety attacks just at the thought of it. But, you know, I always say that authors are like magpies, and that we're always, always flying around looking for shiny objects to put into our books. And that was a thing. And I just thought, that's a really great, that would be a great thing to put into the novel.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, you think as a novelist, one of the questions I'm always asking myself is, what if, what if? And so when I thought about this, I thought, well, what if Celeste or Camille didn't actually burn all of the books, and what if she kept one for herself? And then I asked, and what if there was a secret in that notebook that everybody had thought had been burned but actually hadn't been burned?
Okay.
And so from that little acorn, this entire book grew. That was really the first sort of plotty type thing, technical writerly term, plotty type thing that I sort of latched onto.
Okay.
And so that became a lot of the driving force of the narrative, certainly of Camille's story. So that was her. And then the other three characters who are all male, were totally the figment of my imagination. You know, one is called Guillaume, and he's a painter, and I suspect a not very good painter, actually, who is sort of suffering from a bad case of unrequited love, and is also on the run from some hoodlums that he's borrowed money from and now can't repay. And, you know, I just thought, well, if you're writing about Paris in the 20s, you got to have an artist in there. I mean, you're quite right, Stacey, when you talk about that time. I mean, to be in Paris in the 1920s was I mean, it blows my mind just thinking about it, because the creative explosion that happened after World War One, and just, if you know, people I think looked around and thought, well, good Lord, we survived that, and just thought, well, all the rules go out of the window at this point. And so whether it's Picasso and Bach, or whether it's musically in Stravinsky, it was just an extraordinary time. So, but I wanted to have a painter in there. And then one of the other characters is called Jean-Paul, and he's a writer. And I'm just going to put my hand up and go, well, he's a writer, so I'm interested in writers. So, and he, you know, he's a journalist actually, but he's written a book, and he is a, and I see he tells other people's stories, because he has a story of his own, but it's almost too sad to tell. So, so there's that. And then the final character is a little different from those two, in that he is an Armenian. He's a refugee from the Armenian genocide, and his name is Soren. And he performs puppet shows in the public gardens of Paris for the children, but he performs them in Armenian and not in French. So that is an interesting little twist. And again, on the subject of magpies, that idea has been bouncing around my head for the last 25 years or so.
Oh, wow.
I have a very good friend who lives in London, who I used to work with, whose name is Rafi Varugian, which is about as Armenian a name as you can have. And he and I both suffer from a lifelong affliction, which is an undying love of Arsenal Football Club, which is a soccer team.
Okay.
In the Premier League, and we both had season tickets, and so we would go and watch the games, and we would meet up beforehand in a pub and have a pint of beer before we went to the game. And it was during those pre-match drinks that Rafi told me about the Armenian genocide and the campaign to have it recognized as such, and the horrors that took place. And, you know, I was appalled at the stories that he told me, because they are just beyond belief in terms of how horrendous they were. But I was also appalled that I didn't know about it. And it just struck me as being so, I mean, I was ashamed that I didn't know about this until somebody told me. And I still can't fathom why this isn't taught in schools, why people aren't more aware of it.
Very rarely taught.
Yeah. And so, you know, one of the great privileges and joys of writing books is that you get a tiny little soapbox and an opportunity to stand on it. And I'm mixing my metaphors here, and then to shine a light on, you know, certain things that you think are important. And so I always wanted to write about the Armenian genocide in some way, but never, the opportunity never really arose until this book came along. And then as I was thinking about the stories I wanted to tell, I thought, okay, well, this actually would be an opportunity for me to do that. So, you know, we first meet Soren, and we learn about how he left his home and how he got to Paris, and why he is the way that he is. And it's a very sad story. And it was a painful one to write, but it's, I'm very fond of it. And you know, the issue when you address things like that in fiction, and the I always have, is that I'm going to do it just, you know, this was a terrible, terrible time, and the absolute last, you know, you want to honor the memory of what happened, and not to be, well, you just want to do it right. And I'm happy to say that Rafi read the book and he told me I did it right. So that
was, that's great.
It's a relief. Yeah.
Because when I was reading about like the different characters, I was like, okay, you have the artist, you have a writer, you have a maid who's connected to the, you know, celebrities and whatnot. And then when I read about him, I was like, oh, like that's interesting. I wouldn't have put it together. And I happened to learn about the Armenian genocide in school, but that's because I took like an optional class and I was like, oh, this sounds interesting. One of the most depressing classes I've ever taken. I forgot what it was called, but it was just all about like the Armenian genocide, the Holocaust, like just negative events in history, world history, I think he called it. And I was just like, oh my God, this happened. But like, why didn't we learn this earlier?
Right.
And
right.
It's nice to kind of see that because the one book I know offhand that addresses it happens to be Chris, I'm going to butcher his name because I don't know how to pronounce it correctly. Chris Bohalian. So Sandcastle Girls. And I'm like, I know that one. And it's nice to see like this brought in. And so the hardcover came out last year. Was that at all affected by the pandemic? Did you have to push back anything?
It was completely affected. There was a 2-week national tour lined up and everything got canceled. I did do some events on Zoom, of course, and that was fun, but it's not the same as going and meeting people in person. The bookshop at the time was closed, I believe. Yes, it was. And so we shipped out, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of copies of the book on the day that it was published, which was wonderful.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, we didn't have a launch party. We didn't do any of these things. And, you know, I remember telling myself, well, at least when the paperback comes out, we'll be able to do all of that. And of course we haven't and we can't.
No.
But that's fine. It's, you know, I know a lot of people who have had both the hardcover and the paperback come out during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. it's a little rough, but but we're all in the business of finding silver linings where we can these days. And one of the great things has been, once everyone sort of realized that this wasn't going to go away anytime soon, you know, bookshops are very innovative people and the people who run them. And suddenly the invitations came in to do a lot of events. And so I ended up doing an event in, where was it? Just outside San Francisco on one night. And then the next night I was in Provincetown in Massachusetts.
Oh, wow.
But without ever leaving my bedroom. So you know, the pandemic has allowed authors to, via Zoom to actually reach more people. I mean, it's not as much fun. There isn't the same degree, the same degree of connection, but it's still something. And there are a couple of authors I'm just going to mention, Jenna Blum and Caroline Levitt, who together started this incredible thing called A Mighty Blaze, which is this incredible thing that they just put together for authors who have books coming out.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's just a way of amplifying and letting people know about these releases. So, you know, if any of your patrons want to go and just Google A Mighty Blaze, and every week they do dozens and dozens of events. I'm actually doing one on Friday.
Which that's is exciting.
And it's just, yeah, it's wonderful. And it's a great resource and it's a great way of finding out about new releases. So I would recommend it. A Mighty Blaze.
Good. That's awesome. Cause at least our library, which is in Syosset, New York, part of Long Island. So it was entertaining. And like one of the jokes between me and some colleagues are that I created the pandemic because right as I was coming back from my maternity leave, everything went on lockdown. Like I was supposed to come back into work and then I got the call like, no, we're closing. And I was like, what? Because I was just like, what's happening outside my house? I was home with my son who's now 16 months, going to be 17 months in a week, crazy.
But they grow up fast, Stacey. I tell you, my son just turned 20, so.
Oh my God, well, happy birthday to him. But it's definitely been an interesting time being home with him during all this, but. Yeah.
Oh my.
We had the shutdown and so many books got stopped being published or made. And I remember when we came back, we opened the building to staff about a year ago, mm-hmm. coming in just boxes of books coming in. And the unfortunate thing with the library, it's not unfortunate, it's the books are still going to be here, but we have new shelves of new fiction, new nonfiction. And because we had so much backlog to do, the new books weren't on the shelves for new as much as they usually are. Like, oh, like 3 months, we have more books, we got to move them. So that's nice that those authors are doing stuff, and that bookshops are also like, they're another great avenue to find books.
Sure. And most bookshops these days are open again. I mean, we mm-hmm. Our doors were closed for several months, and, you know, we have this beautiful space here, and it just turned into a warehouse. We basically did our business model changed completely, and we became a mail order business. And we were just sending out, you know, boxes and boxes and boxes of books every day, and even driving around town delivering them after we closed at the end of the day. So it was very weird, but and you know, we really miss our customers. I mean, independent bookstores are all about customer service and creating relationships with them, and it was very difficult for us not to see them every day in the way that we normally do. But you know, we, like I said, booksellers as a breed are very innovative, and definitely we will, you know, we're grateful still to be here and to have come out the other end, or more or less. Mustn't speak too soon. But I do think that, you know, the old saying about what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I think that the business, and many businesses like ours, will be sort of a bit more robust as a result of this. And we sort of, for example, we didn't used to have an e-commerce website at all, because the whole idea was, well, you come in and speak to us and form a relationship, and then we'll sell you a book. But you know, when our doors were closed for several months, that wasn't possible to do anymore. So we had mm-hmm. to do that, and we'll keep that, obviously. So it's been a difficult, sometimes painful process, but at the end of the day, you know, I think we'll, touch wood, and end up stronger.
It's definitely, I feel like a lot of people did miss that, especially the person-to-person interaction. Like for us, I mean, you said that you've done events on Zoom for stuff, but we've definitely had a lot more author events at our library, because it's so much easier to be like, all right, let's book a Zoom event. We don't need to worry about a budget for food or how many people could fit in a room. And you could watch from the comfort of your own bed if you want. And it's nice to do that, to be like, oh, cool, we got to talk to this author or whatnot. But it's like, I miss being able to be like, oh my God, I really liked this book. And what more could you do? Or like, what have you read? What influenced you, like, to just be in person, like shaking someone's hand?
Yeah, it's different. And you know, you mentioned, I also run the Unbound Book Festival that takes place, usually, you know, in olden days, would take place over a weekend in April. And this year we put it completely online, and we actually did it over 3 months, and we did two events a week. We had over, I think it was 33 events and 69 authors in total, and we had over 40,000 people who watched. But those numbers, I mean, the number of people watching, when we do it in person, we don't get nearly that many people.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's just very easy to do, and people can just, and even if they can't go at the time, it's all on Facebook or.
Yeah, you could watch a recording.
You can watch later. So, you know, there are definite benefits to it, but you're right, it's not the same as being able to shake someone's hand and, you know, ask them, why did you do that thing in that book? You know, whatever it is, you know, and I love asking authors for book recommendations.
That will be one of my questions in a few questions. We always love asking to know.
Okay.
So you're the director, you're the owner of your bookshop, and you are the director of, how did you get involved with the bookshop and the literary festival?
So the literary festival came around, I first got the idea for it back in 2012 when my Well, it's my fifth novel, but my first novel that was published in the US was published, and it was published by Penguin, and I was on a tour, and I was invited to go to a couple of book festivals, one in Maryland and one in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, this is cool. You know, it's like, it's an event all about writers. I mean, what's not to like? Mm-hmm. And Columbia, Missouri, where I live, is a town that loves its festivals. We have several. Yeah, it's a college town, but there are three universities here. And we have one of the leading documentary film festivals in the world called True False, and a really good music festival called Roots and Blues. And so culturally, it's a very rich environment. And we there are lots of readers here, but also a weird number of writers live here too. And so, you know, I got a group of friends together and said, "What do you think? Should we do it?" And they said, "Yeah, why not?" And so we just began. And you know, I always say that the most important thing that I had on my side was a really profound ignorance of what was involved. Because had I understood how much work it was going to be, I probably would have run 100 miles in the other direction. but it, you know, it's gone very well. I mean, we had, so we have a keynote every year, and we've had Michael Ondaatje, who came in the first year to talk about The English Patient, Salman Rushdie.
Oh, wow.
Zadie Smith. And then in 2019, which was the last time we met in person, George Saunders came.
Oh, that's amazing.
So we last time we did it in person, we had over 70 authors, and they come from all across the country, and it's completely free to attend.
Oh, wow.
But it's, you know, it's a lot of work. Anyway, but because of that, and the festival's been received, we've had incredible support from the community. But one thing that a lot of people said to me was, we wish that there was an independent bookstore to sell the books. Because at the time when we began, there was no independent bookstore in Columbia. There was just a Barnes & Noble and a used bookstore. And people kept saying this to me again and again. And so I just began to think, well, maybe there's a gap in the market there. And so the festival came first.
Okay.
And then because of what people said to me, that was when I got the idea of starting the bookshop.
Very cool. I would have thought it would have been bookshop then festival.
Right. And that is the usual way. That is the normal way of doing things, I think. But I can generally be relied upon to get that stuff wrong.
It's all right. It's been working out really well for you. So you're doing something right.
Yeah. So far, so good. Yeah.
Now back to the question I said I'd ask. So what books do you recommend? Have you read anything recently that you love?
Yeah, I've read a ton, but I'm going to do this annoying thing. So Colson Whitehead has a new book coming out in September called Harlem Shuffle, and it's just great.
Okay.
It's so, so good. It's set, well, obviously set in Harlem in the late 50s and early 60s, and it's wonderful. And then another great book, it's called Matrix by Lauren Groff. And again, that doesn't come out until September either, but that is weirdly, but brilliantly set in an English nunnery in the 1100s, which is so different from her last book to be, you know, just slightly sort of mind blowing, but she is such an incredible writer that she can do anything. So those are two recently that I'm excited to talk about and to sell when they come out. And one of the books that I often recommend to people when they come into the shop is a book called The Book of Delights by Ross Gay, which is it's a book of micro essays. And he set himself as an exercise of writing about one thing every day from one birthday to his next birthday. Writing about one thing that delighted him. And that's what he did. And it's quite a small book, but it's completely charming, occasionally really weird, utterly lovely. And the way that we sell it, there's a picture of Ross on the back cover, and he's got this enormous smile on his face. And we just open it up to the back cover and say, look, if you read this book, you will feel like this. It's like happiness in your hand. And so that is a very, it's a great gift for people, but it's also a good gift just for yourself.
You know,
these days we all need cheering up every so often. And
that's true.
Ross has got a real talent in addition to being, I mean, he's an exquisite poet. That's really what he's known for. But this book is just, is beautiful.
Oh, so I'll have to see if our library has it, because now I want to read it.
Yeah, no, you should. It's great.
As for the other two, I will probably wait until September, because I, as a librarian, we also get a bunch of galleys. Pretty much what you can see behind my colleague's thing, they're all advanced reader copies that she has. Probably some of them are old by now, but it's very fun getting them. So since you're both a writer and a bookseller, do you get like double the amount or?
No, I get far, far more as a bookseller than I do as a writer. I mean, I'm asked to blurb books. Mm-hmm. I'm always happy to do that. So that reminds me, so I will give you one more, which again is coming out in September, I think. But it's called The Perfume Thief by Timothy Chaffert. And I read, and that's set in Paris during World War II. Timothy's a really interesting writer and never does anything completely straight on. There's always a slight, ooh, something weird going on. And as that's the case with this book, and it's completely brilliant and very well written. So I'm you know, always happy to do that when I can. But I mean, we got a box this morning in the bookshop from the American Booksellers Association with, there must have been 30 or 40.
Wow.
One of which I'm quite excited about, is the Lily King has a short stories that's coming out in November, so I'm excited about that. So I open the box, so I get to nab all the good ones.
that happens sometimes with coworkers. Like, we'll get a box and it's like, what's in it? Oh, I want this one.
Right.
I could say we don't get as many as a bookseller would of galleys, and usually we have to request them. But I will say one of the easier things, since I guess with technology and everything, usually we use like Edelweiss or NetGalley. I use NetGalley. It's on my phone and I could just quickly read it and give my feedback. And then I'm like, yes, got to read a book. But have you been working on anything since?
Yeah, I have.
Allowed to talk about it? I should ask that first.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to give too much away, because I do believe about sort of letting the heat out of the oven. but it's been a long time. I mean, a lot of people, I think, assume that all writers have been writing up a storm during the pandemic. But to the best of my knowledge and the people I've spoken to, the opposite is true. Mm-hmm. It's been very, very difficult to write much. I was on a panel with Anne Patchett last week, and she said that she's not been able to, she's been writing, but she's been writing essays, completely unable to write fiction. And I'm much the same. Well, I wish I'd been writing essays, but I finally have begun a new novel. I began three or four and abandoned them after 10,000 words. You know, I write so slowly that I really have to be confident that the story has legs, and the first three didn't, but I think this one does. So I am
exciting.
Back in the saddle, but it's a long haul for me. It takes a long time.
Okay. Well, we're looking forward to it whenever it comes out. That's fun. But thank you for talking to us, Alex.
Of course. It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
So we'll close this chapter of Turn the Page podcast.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.